Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
We are going to talk about the financial meltdown, which I covered at length in my book, Trickle Up Poverty, about Wall Street and some of the characters involved in orchestrating the downfall and how they profited and how none of them went to jail. We all know about that, and that led to the election of this unknown politician from Chicago named Barack Obama. We understand that. Many of us who listen to the show regularly believe that that scenario is absolutely true. What you don't know, you're going to learn today. Turn on the TV and I watch a show on HBO, Too Big to Fail. And I was captivated by it for a number of reasons. One, because it was one of the greatest propaganda pieces ever put out by HBO, known very well for its left-wing fanaticism. So you have actors in it such as Ed Asner playing Warren Buffett. Ed Asner, I don't have to tell you, is one of the biggest asses in the history of the world. Well-known, fanatic, psychotic leftist. And he plays Warren Buffett as a grandfatherly man who saves the universe. But he does a fabulous job as an actor. Now, here's the whole point. I've told you before is I love movies. It's just that I'm very sensitive to their bias, and I can read through it, and I can still enjoy it while saying, oh, that's a bunch of you-know-what, okay? So I watched the movie, and you've got great actor James Woods, the only conservative that I know of in the film. He plays the only villain in it, Dick Fuld, in the movie. Dick Fuld, you may remember, and we're going to talk more about him if I can remember where to find it, is the man who busted out, or shall we say permitted to be busted out, one of the great American companies, the Lehman Brothers. Here's a company that was 140-some-odd years old. Dick Fuld let it go down, but he didn't lose a dime. In fact, what was missing from this HBO movie, Too Big to Fail, was virtually everything. I truly believe, and I could never prove it. In fact, let me just put it as a question, okay? I'll put it as a question. Here's the question. Did Hank Paulson pay the director to make this movie? Remember, they made a fortune, these people who busted out America and brought us Barack Obama. Cast of the movie, Too Big to Fail. Well-known fanatic leftist. Billy Crudup plays Timothy Geithner. I don't have to tell you who Timothy Geithner is. He's now the Treasury Secretary. He was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank during the crash. Now they moved him up to be their point man inside the Treasury Department. He's doing exactly what they want him to do once again. And again, the movie is worth watching if you're really interested in what led up to the economic collapse. However, I wouldn't say take it with a grain of salt. I would say take it with a copy of Trickle Up Poverty and read one chapter in that book only, which is the Wall Street, you know, the meltdown on Wall Street. You've got Paul Giamatti playing Ben Bernanke. He literally channeled the bearded one. He channeled the bearded one. And, of course, he pretends to be a he portrays Ben Bernanke as a voice of reason and calm. When experts in the field of finance tell us that Ben Bernanke is a fool, an academic fool who doesn't understand the first thing about the real world, and number two, by artificially controlling and keeping interest rates at near zero to this day, he's actually causing a disaster in our economy. It's why the economy is stalled. It's because of Ben Bernanke's insane policies of keeping interest rates at near zero. We understand he's trying to control inflation. He doesn't want an inflationary trend to occur. But what he's doing instead is destroying the economy, according to experts, and we're going to talk about that. And one of the reasons the stock market has gone down, I believe, is because the head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is merely a professor who lives in Ivory Tower. He may know a lot about the history of the Great Depression, which was his area of expertise in college, but I don't think he knows very much about the man on Main Street. To date, not one major figure from the Wall Street crisis of 2008 has been investigated, arrested, or had their assets seized. Please remember that Bernie Madoff, although a con artist, was not a major player in the disaster. Let me repeat that. The Treasury Secretary, as played by, who played him? Henry Paulson, William Hurt. Henry Paulson, we are not accusing him of any crime, but he was the Treasury Secretary, and he violated the law all over the map. He broke every law. He broke many laws. Let's start with that. Let's not make an extravagant statement. The laws that he violated were astonishing. Then you have Geithner himself, the laws that he allegedly violated, not only according to this movie Too Big to Fail, which is a liberal movie, but according to people who really know what went on. Again, these are actionable offenses. Let's go down the list. I mentioned some names you may not know. John Mack, never heard of him, right? Jamie Dimon, vaguely you know one of him. I think Morgan Stanley, played by Bill Pullman. Some of the other characters, Warren Buffett, I said, played by Edward Asner. Barney Frank. Barney Frank is in the audience, played by Dan Hedaya. And they do a very good job on Barney, but they don't actually get his voice. But Barney should be in jail, according to many people, because it was Barney, with Franny, who made the banks give loans to people that couldn't qualify. So many people believe Barney actually should be in prison for the things that he did, irrespective of the fact that he's a very big liberal, big mouth, and scares everybody with his big, big yap. And the fact is he actually broke the law in many, many ways, and Barney should be in prison, according to many people. Not one major figure from the Wall Street crisis has been investigated or arrested. How about the man who was supposed to guard the hen house? George Bush's hand-picked stooge, Christopher Cox, then head of the SEC. His job was to make sure what happened didn't happen. His job was to stop the actions of Wall Street. Instead, he looked the other way, and he was complicit in it. Why was he never investigated? Why is he enjoying life as a lawyer in Southern California today? People are asking these questions, and there's no satisfactory answer other than we're living in a literally worse than a banana republic. Worse than a banana republic, because there is no social justice in this country. Now, I am using a loaded phrase of social justice because I want to turn it back on the leftists who misuse it. We all want real social justice, but I have discovered, and as you will discover by listening to today's show very carefully, the left-wing zillionaires use the thugs in the street, such as those in Acorn, such as those in the other groups that I'm going to mention, specifically to guard and protect their own interests and to attack their competition and business. This you may not know. Real social justice would see the indictment, the investigation, the indictment, and the trial of the individuals who gave us the financial meltdown. That's real social justice. But as I explained in the Nightmare on Wall Street chapter of my book, Trickle Up Poverty, both Democrats and Republicans laid the groundwork for this financial disaster. You see, Bill Clinton signed the law which eliminated the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated traditional banks from investment institutions. Republican Securities and Exchange Head Christopher Cox eliminated the uptick rule, which allowed for massive short selling. Clinton is enjoying an easy retirement in Rockland County, New York, around the world, in a lecture circuit. Christopher Cox has a cushy job in a law firm in Orange County, where he's still allowed to handle financial matters. In fact, his expertise is, of course, banking and the financial world. Now, why is it that other major figures who are responsible for our economic debacle, such as Herbert and Marion Sandler, do those names ring a bell? You're going to hear a lot more about Herbert and Marion Sandler. We all heard about Bernie Madoff. We all heard about all of those people. We know that a big ticket arrest was made on Wall Street, and a large, heavyset man of Indian extraction was recently indicted and sent to jail, but he was a minnow in a sea of whales. There are those who argue there should be a major investigation of Herbert and Marion Sandler, and yet no one's ever heard of them. Oh, they were once put on Saturday Night Live, and they were ridiculed, but I can't stop thinking about this. I'm obsessed with the topic, because I've never seen such a massive criminal act conducted by so many people, none of whom have been indicted, arrested, or sent to prison.
Savage.
We're talking about an HBO movie, Too Big to Fail. It is sort of a greeting card from those who did it to us, telling us that they were really heroes. The only villainous character, and even a mild villain, by the way, is Dick Fuld, played by James Woods. And Dick Fuld, as played by James Woods, James Woods is a known conservative. He played the only villain. Everyone else was a hero. Everybody else, as portrayed in this movie, whether it be William Hurt playing Hank Paulson, or Paul Giamatti playing Ben Bernanke, or Billy Crudup playing Timothy Geithner, or Ed Asner playing Warren Buffett, portrays a hero who saved us from the next depression. I don't believe it. I actually believe that we're going into another depression, specifically because those who caused the last one are still there. And if they're not in active power, they're behind the scenes, still controlling the scene, using puppets like Geithner to do their bidding and Bernanke to do their bidding. Nothing has changed. In fact, the bonuses are still the same. The salaries are still the same. The same characters are still there. And there's been no investigation or indictment of those who did it to us. Now, if I were alone in this, you could say that I'm wrong. That's number one. But it's funny how both left and right agree with me on this. That's number one. But before we go down this road to any greater extent, and I'm going to cover this in such detail today, you're not going to believe it. You're going to hear things you've never heard or read before. I can guarantee it. I may not even take a single call. Call if you want. But I'm telling you, you're going to learn things you never knew about today, about the economic collapse. And remember, 280 points down today. Hope it goes up tomorrow. But when you have an economy being manipulated like this by short sellers, and you have it manipulated by a Bernanke who artificially keeps interest rates at near zero, you have a recipe for a real Great Depression. We're also going to talk about some loan sharks who busted out a bank, made $2.5 billion on their own, sold it to another bank, and then ran off with the money and funded, you ready for this? Acorn. They funded the group Acorn, MoveOn.org, Media Matters, ProPublica. They've given them tens of millions of dollars. They're the single largest donor to the ACLU with, in my opinion, their ill-gotten gains. And you never heard of them. Why would these billionaires, Herbert and Marion Sandler, not be known? And why would Herbert and Marion Sandler spend all this money, assuming they're so rich, which obviously they are, they sold their bank, which was filled with toxic mortgages, to another bank just before the collapse. They sold it for $25 billion, even though the bank was loaded with toxic mortgages. The bank they sold it to nearly went bankrupt because, obviously, there was nothing that they bought, basically a pig in the poke, a dying pig, and they thought it was a healthy pig. The fact of the matter is, what did they do with their money? Did they fund conservative causes? No, all their causes are extreme leftist groups like Acorn, MoveOn.org, Media Matters, and ProPublica. Now, why would billionaires support the left? This is a question that many of you have asked and shaken your head over and you don't know. You can come up with the comedic answer that liberalism is a mental disorder, but unfortunately, in this case, when it comes to finances, that doesn't apply. These are some of the smartest people on earth. And let's not forget that some of these people we're talking about today are much smarter than us. They always were smarter in school. They knew how to learn faster. They went to better schools than you or I did. I'm very proud of my education, but I wasn't as smart as some of these financial guys, and I'll admit it. But before we go down this road, I want to remind you of something. I am not a poor man. I may sound like I'm a guy in the street with nothing, but I'm a wealthy man. I have worked for, how old am I? I've worked for over 55 years. I've worked since I'm 6 years old. I've saved a lot of my money. I invested a lot of my money wisely. I've never stolen a dime from anybody, ever. Every dime I've made, I've earned. Every single dime I've made, I've earned. Now, having said that, I still carry myself as though I am a worker. I began as a social worker. Then I was a teacher. I struggled as a grad student. I struggled for 20 years because I couldn't get the position I wanted because I was a white male, and the society said white males need not apply. And instead of going into the banking industry or the insurance industry because I knew nothing about it and I wasn't mathematically inclined and I was always a do-gooder, really, I wanted to do something good for the world. Somehow I stumbled into radio after many, many years, and here I am 16, 17 years later, and I'm not telling you that I'm doing badly. I don't want to deceive you. So I'm in a hybrid position in American society. I have outrage against thievery, to be very frank with you. To me, these guys are no different than the mafia. And in watching Too Big to Fail, I thought that I was watching The Godfather. But instead of going to the school of Little Italy, these guys went to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. Instead of slurping spaghetti, they were eating oatmeal in the morning. Instead of downing a little a cappuccino or an espresso, they were drinking bottled water. But it was the same exact mentality of robbing and cheating and obfuscating their theft.
Savage.
Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures that I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority. Last night, as I stood in the museum drinking my cheap red wine and watching the old white people devour the buffet as though they had been starving, who didn't even listen to the great music, didn't even look at a Rodin sculpture, they didn't even look at where they were. All they saw was free quiche and free meatballs. And I said, take a look around, Michael. There's Western civilization for you. The older people don't even know that they have a civilization. All they do is follow their nose to the free meatballs. And there we have the barbarians at the gates being protected by Gates himself.
Savage.
Henry Miller's statement that it's a cosmic joke. All of life is a cosmic joke, whether it's waiting for coffee for 15 minutes in San Francisco till the darling liberals get through brewing it for you. They think you have nothing to do but stand around and wait for a brewed coffee. What I go there for? I wanted a coffee and to go back to the radio station. 10 minutes, 12 minutes in a line like they're giving away gold for nothing. All of the precious children from the University of California at Santa Cruz who can't get a job. They're barristers now. That's their prize. They started out as artists. Now they're brewing coffee. It's a cosmic joke. The whole thing's a cosmic joke. $12 for a cocktail is a cosmic joke. Bad Chinese food is a cosmic joke. Ersatz Italian food with Mexican spices on it is a cosmic joke. 86-degree weather in San Francisco is a cosmic joke. The lack of a mayor in San Francisco is a cosmic joke. Let's go down the list. Everything's a cosmic joke, except me. I'm the only non-cosmic joke. I know I'm real, because if I step on a nail, it hurts like hell. If I lose a tooth, it's painful. When I get a headache, I know.
To an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
WTNT Washington, D.C. Kelly, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. How about
Hi. In
the future you could open perhaps a classical education school for children, because you're classically educated, and maybe even promote the arts towards conservative and traditional values.
That is so nice to hear your voice in the midst of all of this confusion. That's a very beautiful idea. I doubt very much that I could open a school, you know, that's a very complex thing to do. I was considering a Savage conservative scholarship program, and I still am seriously considering it, where I put together a panel of people and we review things that are written by college students, and we give, you know, like $10,000 scholarships to the winners, 10 a year, sure, to help them with their tuition or whatever. I thought that would be a way to do it, right?
Sure, that would be terrific, because, I mean, to get the future generations to actually think somewhat like you do, even just a smidgen like you do, the way to get them is to get the young minds. And, you know, you have
How do you take a young mind that has been raised in American schools and have them even think at all? How do you get them to even think?
Well,
I don't think they know. I don't believe they know how to think. They're told to groupthink. They're taught never to think for themselves, even though the big lie in the schools is that we're teaching you to do your own thing, but in fact they're teaching them to do the teacher's thing. They're teaching them to do it takes a village thing. They're not teaching them to do their own thing at all. It's all brainwashing.
That's right. I mean, no gender, no race, no identity, no creed.
All right, let's start with no sexual identity, because that's considered some kind of obic, some phobic of some kind if you have a sexual identity. Okay, no national identity, because that's considered nativist to the psychopaths. And now let's go down the list. Even family is looked upon with disdain. A family of a mother and father is now spit upon by the internationalists. You know that as well.
I agree.
Okay. So now how do you take a child who's at the age of 20 years old and sit him down and start with the basics? How do you teach him anything? You would need a man with the mind of an Aristotle to do something like that. I'll tell you how I would do it. You want to hear how I would do it? I make it very simple. If you gave me 20 people at the age of 20 who had been brainwashed in American schools and were told, okay, you want to teach them something about the real world and real humanity, how the most of the world looks at the world, not through the eyes of the psychopaths in the American educational system, I'd start with Plato's Republic. And I would read the classics like Plato's Republic, of course, in English translation, and because he goes through, you know, what is the purpose of the state? What is the purpose of the warrior class? What is the purpose of the poet? You know, he wanted to kick the musicians out of his republic. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but another thing...
Oh, go and read Plato's Republic. You're in for a real treat. In Plato's Republic, the interlocutor says, and what of the musicians? And, of course, in the dialogue, he says, the musicians should be thrown out of the state, for they mislead the children. Thank you for the call. I would start with Hollywood.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Tom on WTNT, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I heard your broadcast about individuals who've been falsely accused of child sexual abuse. I'm an attorney in the Washington, D.C. area, and my entire practice is dedicated to representing individuals who've been falsely accused. And I do that.
Oh, my God. Well, that must be an amazing book of horrible lives that have been ruined by this. How do you defend against such witch trial cases?
There have been a number of very notable witch trial cases, like the Emerald case up in Massachusetts.
Oh, yes, that was the worst. They went away for how many years?
Violet Emerald was only released from prison just for a very short period of time before she died of cancer. And her son, Gerald, stayed in prison, a couple of years longer than that. But
and these were people who ran a school, and they were falsely accused of having a magic room that never existed, and the children were put on the stand by detectives. Isn't that true?
Yes, that's true.
So what kind of cases do you typically get, Tom?
My specialty is representing people who've been accused by young children, that'd be children under the age of 6, because we know from the psychological literature that children that age can be subject to suggestion. And what we see is, for example, estranged spouses or girlfriends saying to their children, "Didn't daddy do something to you?" And then they're interviewed by social workers or detectives who have a bias, and then the poor child gets so confused and they start assimilating what they've heard, what's been suggested to them. And then,
well, Tom, how do you defend when you're not allowed to cross-examine a child? Can you put a child 5 years old on the stand?
Since the decision of the United States Supreme Court in the Crawford case, a child has to testify. If a child is complaining they've been abused, they have to testify. But before they would get on the witness stand, competent defense attorneys conduct what they call a competency taint evaluation to determine, number one, if the child is saying something that they actually remember, or if the child is saying what the child has been programmed to talk about.
But unbelievable. Well, so this is an epidemic in America, is it not?
You know that prior to this decision of the Supreme Court, children were able to be talked to in closed rooms by social workers and detectives, and then those individuals were able to repeat what the child said, and the poor defendant, the father, the boyfriend, never had an opportunity to cross-examine the child, but that's all been abolished now. So really the aggressive and competent defense attorneys who realize that children often make statements that are not supported by reality, they conduct these competency taint evaluations, and they bring in mainstream psychologists to testify about the issues of suggestibility. There was a wonderful study. I know you're busy, but let me just tell you about this study.
No, wait, Tom, let me say this. You're doing really valuable work, because I believe there's an epidemic, a sub rosa epidemic of false accusations in this country. Would you agree with my generic statement that the predominant number of individuals falsely accused are white males? Is that a fair assessment in your practice?
Yes.
And would you say that it's generally white males with some property in general?
Actually, not necessarily, because it cuts across all socioeconomic groups, but it's primarily whites. It's primarily males and primarily whites. You're exactly
so
right.
Then so then would it be fair to conclude that those who have little or no property are being ripped apart for reasons of vendetta, just to destroy them?
Yeah. And not only that, the people that don't have the money and the right resources to hire competent counsel to get defended. If you get convicted of a child sexual abuse, you're going to go to jail. Number two, you're going to be on the sexual registry for the rest of your life.
Oh, my God.
Savage.
Joining us now is an attorney in Washington, D.C., Thomas A. Pavlinek, who specializes in defending the falsely accused. Mr. Pavlinek, welcome back to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be back. It's an important message that you're sending, and it's the passion of my life. That's all I do. My practice is limited to representing people who've been falsely accused. And my practice gets sometimes 20 to 25 calls a day through our website from people across the country reaching out to us for help. That's a staggering amount.
Give us your website, because, Thomas, give us your website.
My website is Premier Defense Group, P-R-E-M-I-E-R, Premier Defense Group, www.premierdefensegroup.com. .com, that's correct.
All right, so give us the next big case of a man falsely accused and how you defended him, please.
It comes right to mind. I represented a school psychologist out of Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, and he was accused by his adopted son of multiple rapes. And the rapes were supposed to have gone on for 7 years. And when the case went to trial, there was no medical evidence to support anything that was said, nothing. And this young man had gone to court numerous times complaining about other problems that he was having with people, and he didn't bring these allegations against his stepfather until his stepfather got tired of bailing him out of jail and getting lawyers for him and finally said to him, you know, son, you're on your own. And he went in to the police. When he was 22 years of age, and said his father had been sexually abusing him from ages 9 to 17, and he was making those allegations 13 years later.
So how did you defend this case?
How did I defend it? Well, we brought in a top notch gastroenterologist from Washington D.C., Ken Brown, to come to Pittsburgh to testify. As many times as this young man said, 600 times, he would have had all of these medical problems, and there were no medical problems. In addition to that, the client had his own children testify that there was none of this abuse took place. Plus, we had pictures and other independent members of the family to establish what a good kid he was all through his high school years. But when the client was arrested in 2003, the trial didn't take place until 2010. The trial lasted 16 days. The jury deliberated for 4 days, and he was found not guilty of all counts. But it bankrupted him, Mike. He lost his position. We're now in the position of getting back his school position, his psychological license. He went bankrupt. It was a very humiliating and depressing time for him, but he had a lot of mettle. He fought every step of the way, and I had a really good co-counsel with me, Tim Lucas, who we worked in.
Tom, a couple of questions come to mind. Tom, the boy who made these false accusations, he got off scot-free?
Nothing happened to him. He went back to wherever he was. Nothing happened to him. Nothing.
Okay, so the laws need to be changed, number one, but the victims' rights mafia will never permit victims who falsely accuse individuals of ever being accountable, because they will claim that that will put a damper on them coming forward. And they'll be afraid to make such a statement. And American jurisprudence doesn't permit that. I know what's going to come from this. Now, one other question. Why did the case take 7 years to come to trial?
It's very unusual, and that's a very good question. Pennsylvania has what they call interlocutory appeals. And there's an evidentiary point which the trial judge ruled in our favor, and the Commonwealth asked that it be appealed. And that appeal took 2 years. And in addition, another reason was that the child's natural mother, who was married to my client, initially was accused by her son of the same, you know, grotesque act, and she denied it. And this is probably one of the most perversions of justice. On the day we were supposed to go to trial, the prosecution gave her the ability to take a plea to endangering the welfare of the children, a child, and get a suspended sentence, no jail time, if she would testify against her husband. And then we had that delayed the case another year. And even though the wife testified against her husband, the jury saw right through that because she had real mental and emotional problems. And
My God, what a mess. So we're living in a witch hunt age where any child, anyone really can accuse anybody of anything, really, is what it comes down to. And so how you defend yourself against this is an interesting story. You can do so, but your life is ruined anyway.
Well, you know, what are the police going to do? There's no evidence. But the evidence comes from just somebody saying it. That's what's so frustrating to us to defend these type of cases, because all you have to do is say it. And then you could be arrested. You could lose your job, your security clearance. If you're not a U.S. citizen, you're going to be deported automatically. It doesn't make any difference what your family circumstances are. If you get convicted of a sex crime in the United States of America and you are not a U.S. citizen, you're gone. There's no way that you're going to be able to prevent yourself.
All right, so let's take it back to the case of the rich Frenchman, the IMF guy. Does he have an easy or a very difficult case to prove of his innocence?
Well, his case was a little bit different, Mike, because that's an allegation being made by an adult.
Yes.
And it would have to, whether or not there would be any DNA evidence. Now, I mean, I'm just following what I hear in the press. If they're trying to say that there's some DNA evidence, it's hard for me to comment on that because I'm one of the few people that still believes in the presumption of innocence. Until somebody comes forth and says, here's the evidence, and this is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm assuming that this man is innocent. He would then have to be proven guilty. And if there were some DNA evidence, for example, that she said something on an article of her clothing, and they find that, then that would be evidence that would tilt in favor of the prosecution.
But wait a minute. It still wouldn't. It's from my point of view as a layman, even if his DNA in the form of semen was found on any article of her clothing, it still wouldn't indicate that he raped her. It could have been consensual. She could have agreed to perform a sex act with him for money and then, of course, used that to induce him and then turned on him simply for personal gain. Why can't we assume that she did that?
Well, that's a theory that would have to be developed by his attorneys after they look at all the evidence. And
I understand his defense attorneys, I think it's Bronfman and others, are actually looking at her life back in Guyana. Or Guinea, rather, in Africa, meaning she's a devout Muslim here, but we don't know what she was there. And so, therefore, they're trying to find out if this woman had a sordid life that might indicate behavior other than what she's proposing here. Again, this is a very frightening situation that a man can find himself in, is it not?
Yes, it is. One thing that he has going for him is that he has the financial resources to hire competent counsel who can do that. Just think of the poor guy that's a laborer, a carpenter, or a house painter, making maybe $35,000, $40,000 a year, and he's got a family to support. He gets accused. What does that poor soul do? He doesn't have the money to do that type of thing. So he has to either get public defender or, you know, an attorney who'll take the case on pro bono. How do you get the experts to come in?
But isn't it true that there's a presumption of guilt the minute someone is accused? Are they not immediately castigated by the media?
Yes. That's absolutely
yes.
Correct. In my website, I say that you're presumed guilty. And when you go into the courtroom, you look at the courtroom personnel, how they treat you, and how the whole ambiance of the sheriffs and the bailiffs, they look at you and like, this guy must be some sort of a pervert. And yes, it's the standard of proof is reversed. You've got to go to court, and you've got to be aggressive in your defense of these people, otherwise they're going to be found guilty. You just can't sit back and hope that they're not going to prove their case. You've got to aggressively, you know, we take these cases, we put 100, 200 hours into the defense of them, and we bring in a team, we do a PowerPoint presentation, because it's my life, it's my passion.
What is it? So this must cost at least a few hundred thousand dollars, correct?
Well, the defenses can run between $50,000 and $100,000, and if you get into stratospheric defenses involving international...
I got to tell you this. You know, Tom, I've been falsely accused in England of being associated with murderers and terrorists. You know that, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know that I've spent over $200,000 of my defense fund money, if not more? And I've not even gotten a hearing in England. They refuse to even hear my case. Do you know that? They have completely reversed all of the rules of courts, of the Magna Carta, of freedom of the press, freedom of speech. Everything is upside down. It's Alice in Wonderland. I've spent well over $200,000, and they refuse, this government under Cameron refuses to even acknowledge that I might not be guilty as charged. Would you believe this?
Well, that you're this is the plight of many others who are in that situation, who have spent their life savings and they've gone bankrupt. And I empathize with you because I've seen that happen to my very own clients, not on the same scale, on a lesser scale. Nonetheless, the impact on these people is the same as it has been on you and others like you.
Well, I'm not begging anyone. I'm just saying that these things do cost a lot of money. But if you're dealing with a rigged system, as we have in America, it's rigged against the accused. And in England, they've completely reversed their laws of jurisprudence, where they're now something out of the Salem witch trial age, where you have to prove yourself innocent when they've assumed you are guilty without any trial whatsoever, without any evidence, without any discovery, without even meeting you or hearing from you. They say, Jacques Hughes, it's something out of the ex-Soviet Union. Anyway, your law firm is one of many, several rather, not many in the country, I'd imagine, PremierDefenseGroup.com.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Yeah. It is the Savage Nation. Come on, let's get the music going, guys. Pump them up, pump them up. Get the people going. Bring them into the tent. You know, in a few minutes, I'll get into the whole fantasy of the latest circus created by the Obama administration. But I want to take you back approximately one day. Last night, yesterday, when I got off the air, I was in San Francisco, as I told you. The weather was just unbelievable. It was a Fellini night, I call it. A Fellini night in the sense that it was too hot for me. But the two hot days in San Francisco become perfect nights. No wind, stars in the sky. It's a kind of night you want to sit outdoors and eat. You can't do it most of the time because it's too windy and foggy. So I ambled up to the North Beach restaurant where my friend Lorenzo Petroni is the proprietor. And you know I've gone in and out of there for years. I got to tell you about a night. Because it is a political night in some way, but some way it isn't. And you know they say living well is the best revenge. I got to rank last night as one of the best nights of my life. I know you say, what? Just had a meal? That's all it was? That was one of the best nights of your life? That's the whole point. And I'm going to show you what it was in a minute. So as I say, I go into the restaurant. It's still light out. I get into an argument with Lorenzo immediately because we're like family. We're always arguing over something. Either he's telling me to eat something I don't want to eat, or he's putting salt in my food when I don't want salt, or he's trying to push his soup on me when I don't want the soup. So last night it was over something else. I don't exactly know what it was. And then he says to me, Michael, you want to eat dinner with us? I said, no, I really just want to be alone. I'm exhausted. The show drained me. I'm tired. He said, no, I want you to meet some people. I said, leave me alone. I don't want to meet any people. He said, no, you got to meet these people. Okay, I'll meet the people. He says, no, he owns, he says, up in Bodega Bay, the restaurant, the hotel, the Inn at the Tides. It was the inn in the movie. Remember the movie The Birds? Hitchcock, The Birds up there. I was interested because it's a beautiful town. I haven't been up there in years. He introduces me to Carlo Galazzo, general manager. Carlo and I hit it off right away. And we start to, you know, have some drinks. I don't know how it immediately wound up to burial and death. Now you say, well, wait a minute. I thought this was a good night. Yeah, it was a good night. But let me explain to you why I'm telling you the story. I'm telling you the story, A, because I want to tell you the story. B, because it was a beautiful night. And C, because at the end of the day, eventually Obama will leave us. The plague of the Obama administration will be gone, and most of us will be able to take a deep breath and try to get a few nights in like I had last night. And I'm not going to let him interfere with my ability to have a good drink and a good laugh. So we start to talk, and he had just come back from Italy with Lorenzo, where they went on a wine tour, and they went and visited some of the deceased in a cemetery outside of Lucca, strangely enough. And I was quite surprised to find that that's where some of the folks had been interred. Anyway, turns back to the dinner. So we get to the table, maybe 8, 10 of us. Tables are set up outside. It's long outside now, and he kept bringing more people in. I didn't know who was going to be there. At this point, as Jackie Gleason said, I was feeling no pain. I just drank tons of his Sauvignon Blanc, which he makes out of his own grapes from his estate up in Sonoma. I'm drinking the Sauvignon Blanc, and we're eating the prosciutto, and the sand dabs come, then the broccolini. Then a guy is in the crowd. I don't know if I should mention his name, but he's got a dog named Duke. I'll just call him Matt. Matt's his first name. Now, Matt loves me and loves my show. I never met him. Lorenzo is a big man. Lorenzo is built like an oak tree. Let's put it to you that way. Don't try to arm wrestle Lorenzo. He may be 70-some-odd, but it'll break your hand. Matt makes Lorenzo look like a stick figure. So these guys are terrific. So Matt loves me. I love you. He says, I'm another right winger. He says, if it wasn't for you, I'd go crazy. He said, you are my God. Savage, I love your show. Without you, I'd go out of my mind. Where's your dog, Teddy? I've been wanting to meet you all my life. Where's Teddy? I want to see Teddy. I said, I don't have Teddy with me, but I want you to meet my dog, Duke. And he goes to the car. He opens the car, and Duke comes out. I don't know what kind of dog he was. He was like a cute dog with some terrier with short legs, but very stocky, much, much, much tougher than Teddy. And he says, I said, what do you feed him? He said, well, I feed him only dog food. I don't give him any human food. I said, well, you brought him to the wrong guy, because if you put him next to me at the table, he's going to get some of the bread and olive oil. He said, no, please don't feed him. Anyway, to make a long story short, Duke had some terrific Italian food last night, but I don't think Matt knows it. So we're eating, and the food is coming, and after 4 or 5 glasses of wine, I'm looking already up at the above to the stars, and my eyes stop on the overhead electric wires for the electric buses in San Francisco. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but there are some older cities in America that still have overhead electric wires that they used to use for trolley cars. In San Francisco, they use them for the electric buses. And at a certain point in the night, I felt as though I was sitting right on the edge of the sidewalk in Fellini's Roma, where the trolley car comes within 6 inches of the person sitting on the outermost seat at the table, even though the table didn't go that far out. And I'm looking up at the stars, and I'm talking with these people. We're eating the food. We're drinking the wine. And I'll tell you the truth, it was one of those perfect moments. Now, needless to say, we didn't get into politics, but I do know this. There wasn't a liberal at the table. So let's play a little more Fellini music, and then we'll get into the Obama story here on The Savage Nation. Sand dabs. Sand dabs. It's a San Francisco thing, that fish. Oh, my God. But they were all talking in Italian. They think I don't understand Italian, but I know a bit of it after living here for so many years. I've heard enough Italian to understand the things they're saying. So when I said, when he gave me the sand dabs without any sauce, I said, could you bring me some marinara sauce to put on? He said to his son something fast in Italian, like, what, is he out of his mind? Putting a marinara sauce on a sand dab? It was like listening to a whole thing in translation.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
So we're giving you the yin-yang today, the yin-yang treatment. A touch of Obama, with a dollop of Pacific Sand Dab. Oh, if you think I'm going to break my brains again tonight with Obama with Ground Zero and just get upset over it and his grandstanding, it's not going to happen. It ain't going to happen, I'll tell you that. So what do you want to talk about? Let's see, I got many callers calling about abalone and whale watching. Let's go to New York City. You would think no one knows in New York what abalone is. You're wrong. Amy in New York is on the phone from WR. Amy, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, Michael. I love your show. Well, the minute you said Bodega Bay, it brought back really warm memories. My parents built a house right there on Highway 1 across from a beach called Portuguese Beach with a nice white water view, and we had a telescope out on the balcony. You can watch the whales. The birds are all over the place, just like in the movie. They're all over.
So you were a little kid. You grew up there?
Well, in high school, my parents built a house out there, and I thought, oh, this is great. We would go out.
Where'd you go to high school? In San Francisco?
Carolina High. No, San Rafael.
Oh, you're a Marin County girl.
I am Marin County, born and raised.
And so what are you doing? You're stuck in New York now, or?
Yeah, well, I'm actually in upstate New York, right in the Albany area.
I think Albany is in New York State somewhere. I believe it is somewhere north of New York City. I think it's somewhere north of New York City. I think there is something north of New York City called Albany. I agree with you. So were you there when Hitchcock filmed The Birds?
No, that was filmed much earlier. But in town, Bodega Bay, it's a little bit different than right on the coast. So it's where the restaurant is. So that's a great restaurant.
Oh, yeah, it's unbelievable. It's absolutely, Carlo has a great place up there. Thanks for the call. I'm glad I could bring back some nice memories. New York City, WR, Rachel, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Just before you mentioned that scene, as you were speaking, the scene came to my mind because I've lived in Rome, you know, for a couple of years.
Yeah, but remember that scene where they're eating outdoors on a hot summer night and there's a trolley car, an electric car goes by within inches of the guy sitting at the edge of the table?
Unbelievable.
Remember that? I mean, only Fellini could capture the meaning of that moment, the poetry of that moment, where the guy didn't even care. He was having, first of all, he had such faith in his surroundings that he didn't even fear the trolley car would hit him, number one. I'm trying to use the right word here. It's the existentialism of that particular scene, which is that the trolley car, although it could kill everybody, he had no fear it would turn over and hit him. Well, nobody at the table paid any attention to it. And it also added verve to the dining scene, where you're excited because you're part of this whole swirl of life in Rome at that time, post-World War II Rome. Now, to top it off, you're not going to believe this is a side story, but it's 100% true. Adjacent to us, a couple sits down, and I don't know how we got to talk to them. They turn out that they're two lawyers from Chicago, and they heard it's Michael Savage. They listened to me on WIND, and they wanted to meet me. I said, what do you do? We're lawyers. I said, what firm? They tell me the name of the firm. I said, are you kidding me? I said, one of the lawyers I use is a chief partner. They almost, because the firm has 10,000 lawyers or 3,000 lawyers. That was an amazing situation. So I said, what are you going to do, charge the restaurant $1,600 an hour for the meal you're having? Like in reverse? DD, Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Mr. Savage, I know what broccolini is.
Isn't it a mixture of broccoli and eenie?
No, sir. Broccolini is a hybrid seed, which is a cross between broccoli and Chinese kale.
It's unbelievable. Everybody out in the Bay Area knows this. It's really fabulous stuff. Now, you actually grow it on a ranch?
Yes, we do. But it's a seed that was given to our family's company about 10-plus years ago. We started planting and growing it here in Salinas Valley, and now it's marketed and sold all over the nation.
So people have gotten to taste it, because broccoli by itself is a little rough to eat. It's a wonderful vegetable. I happen to like it when it's steamed very well.
Yes, I agree. The broccoli has got a bit of a bitter taste. My children won't even eat broccoli anymore. They're 7 and 9 years old, and we steam broccolini all the time. They pick it up with their fingers and eat it.
Do you think George Bush would eat broccolini? Because he said he wouldn't eat broccoli, I remember he said years ago. Why don't we send a free case to George Bush and see if we can get him to eat some broccolini?
You know what? I think we should. I think that'd be great.
Thanks for calling the show. I remember George Bush said he doesn't like broccoli. Maybe he'd like broccolini. Who knows? He's definitely a roast beef and mashed potato kind of guy. You know what I'm saying? Nothing wrong with that. I can guarantee you he knows what he's doing. What's good for him is good for him. What else do you want to talk about on the Savage Nation? Anything is a fair game. Let's go to the next caller in Las Vegas. Barry, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I grew up in Santa Rosa. My doctor, my dad was a doctor in Sonoma State Hospital. So on the weekends, we'd either be over at Sonoma's at Sebastiani Winery, or we'd be over at Bodega Bay. All of the kids would be out on the rocks getting the abalone and prying them off at low tide. We'd fill up a couple of carloads of the trunk full of abalone. We'd all head back to Santa Rosa. All the adults and especially the Italians would be in one room drinking wine and laughing. All of us kids would be in the kitchen banging on this abalone to make it soft so you could eat it up. But I
isn't that something? So you have very fond memories of that I provoke with the story of last night, huh?
Oh, listen, being from the Bay Area, I went to Centerville Military Academy in its heyday, but you talk about going up to Napa and the wineries. Half the people you knew and know up there went to school with my mom and dad when they were going to high school in Sonoma. But when you talk about the abalone that we used to get back then used to be a foot long, 10 inches wide. They were huge.
Wow.
Now you get in trouble for just getting an abalone that's 4 or 5 inches, and they've got such restriction. And every once in a while, I see where somebody up there in the Bay Area is going to jail because they're, digging or they're getting the
abalone. Can you imagine going to jail for they're taking out too much abalone in a world like this where you got violent drug gangs running the streets with impunity? They're arresting people for taking out too much abalone. It's astounding.
You mention abalone to anyone who's probably 40 years and younger. They look at you. They don't know what you're talking about.
No, they don't. No, hey, I'm going to tell you something funny. So as I enjoyed the night and it got better and better, and I looked up at the overhead electric wires and I tried to explain to the people the scene from Fellini's Roma. Nobody there knew who Fellini was. Would you believe it?
My dad had a night. I have it in the garage, but my dad bought a brand new 1950 MGTD from British Motors in San Francisco. The manager bought the first one. My dad bought the second one. We would always head down to the wharf, and he'd go in and get a bottle of wine. I'd get a root beer or something, but we'd get the French bread. We'd go out and sit on the table, look at the Golden Gate Bridge and the different ships and boats and things. So,
Oh, so you still have that MG in your garage, the TD?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Amazing. What a memory that is. You remember your dad buying that thing? That's astounding.
Not only remember him buying it, Mike, but it doesn't have any gas gauge. All it has is a red light and a green light. As long as that green light's on.
Oh, I love it. That's like how Obama runs the economy. He thinks it's still running on a green light, but it's a red light by now.
When the red light comes on, that meant that it only had 2 gallons of gas. So I was behind the seat, and there's a little spot behind the seat where you sit there. And I'd look over his shoulder, and as soon as that red light would come on, I'd panic. I'd say, Dad, are you sure we have enough gas to get home? Because we were always either at Bodega Bay or over there at Sebastiani's Winery because they knew them all. And I loved going through those big, huge 1,000-gallon wine vats.
Oh, the cavernous cellars on a hot day, how cool it was, like air-conditioned.
The smell was fantastic, just years and years.
Well, you talk about that. Lorenzo makes his own wine. I was there 15 years ago when he bought his estate. In Sonoma, he cut and cleared all of the brush himself and had all of the vines planted. It was astounding. I was there when he was cutting down the brush. But so last night he was saying at the end of the meal, they were all drinking grappa, which I don't drink. I don't particularly like it. It's too strong. So he started explaining how they make grappa from the must of the grape. You probably know about that, right? Amazing how strong grappa is.
You were mentioning the birds over there in Bodega Bay. I almost was used as one of the school kids when the birds was being filmed. But a little bit later, I was in a motion picture with Betty Davis called The Storm Center that was filmed in Santa Rosa. She was a librarian, and she wanted to have communist books in the library to expose people and let them read what communism was all about. And the city father said, no communist books in our library. So that's what the whole movie was all about.
Today the opposite is true. No patriotic books allowed in U.S. libraries.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
talking about the vermin in the media, men like Anderson Cooper, who was so in love with his own image that he doesn't understand that he himself has become the enemy of freedom, that during the riots in Egypt a few months ago, he was up excited on CNN talking about the young men in tight dungarees with Blackberries who were simply demanding freedom and the overthrow of Mubarak. And now we wake up and Christians are being killed, churches are being burned, and there's no Anderson Cooper or anyone else from the American media to tell you what is actually going on in Egypt. I told you on this show what would happen. I told you the Muslim Brotherhood would rise up, and many of you heard me, many of you believed me, many of you understood I saw what was coming, but unfortunately not enough of you to have stood up to the big lie. So again, maybe you want to rename this show from the Savage Nation to Standing Up to the Big Lie, because to me there's a big lie coming out of this White House virtually every second. I realized that it was said back in the days of Hitler by his propaganda minister that if you tell a big lie often enough, it will become the truth. And so if Anderson Cooper keeps talking about the Arab Spring over and over again, maybe you won't know about the Christians being killed throughout the Middle East. If the White House keeps calling illiterate gutter rats poets, eventually you will start to think that illiterate gutter rats are poets. But you're not going to convince me of either. Talk Radio Network. You're an independent syndicator. Two, I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. I overhear normal people talking about where they're going this summer, and a part of me has a nostalgic jealousy. It's not that I couldn't travel and go away sometime this summer. It's just that I don't travel and go away in the summer. I have nowhere I want to go. What am I going to go to France and go to Italy? I mean, if I want to go to France, I go to San Francisco to a French restaurant, which I never do. A, I don't like French food, and B, I don't like French waiters. So let's put an X through that. If I want Italian food, I go to North Beach and I go to certain restaurants, mainly one. And you know the restaurant, I don't have to mention it. I go to the North Beach restaurant and suddenly I'm in Italy. First of all, I speak in Italian. Secondly, the food is better than in Italy. The ingredients are fresher. And third, I know them and they know me, and I know that the fish is fresh. It wasn't doctored up to make it taste good. So I myself, doesn't mean you shouldn't travel. I'm not going to change your mind. I don't understand why anybody would want to travel. I remember when I was a young man and I was on a troop ship converted to a student ship. I told you the story over and over again. It was a great trip, by the way, 10 days across the Atlantic on the MV Waterman. I remember it to this day. It was an old troop carrier. I had a terrific time. I really did. And, you know, I met an older guy. He must have been 25. And he said to me, just remember, kid, being on the road is exhausting. As you get older, you'll find out, meaning older, when you hit 25, that the only reason to travel, he said, are funerals and weddings. I think he's right. Therefore, I hope I won't be traveling in the near future. My family knows this, and it's sad in a way because they're different than me. They love travel. They're normal people. They're not in talk radio. They're not in the media. I mean, being in the media, how could you travel? I don't understand it, truthfully. The center of my universe right now is my home studios, my dog, my kitchen. As an old wise philosopher said to me when I was very young and broke and was very worried that I wasn't getting ahead in the world, and I went to him for advice. He was an old world guy, and he said, what are you worried about? I said, well, I'm not making a great living. I can't get ahead. I have young children. I don't know what the future is going to hold for me. And he said, what are you worried about? He said, what does a man really need? He said, the teachings tell us that what a man really needs is a desk, a lamp, a chair, and a toilet. In other words, he reduced it down to the basics. He wasn't really too far from the truth. When you actually analyze what you really need, especially if you have an active mind, do you really need to go to meetings unless you're selling something or you want a network? No. Truthfully, in the age of the internet, there's no reason to go anywhere. It's sad to say, it's true. And it can get very, very addictive and suck you right in. But I myself, while resisting it for so many years, I live on the internet. I'm on it from 5 o'clock in the morning till midnight. I'm sorry to tell you, I am. I live in the cyber world. But the cyber world is really the world that we inhabit. We can learn so much, and we know what's going on in the world. Is it everything? No. I mean, no, it's not everything. Of course not. But I really feel bad for people who are not on the net every morning looking at what's going on in the real news. They don't go on to the Drudge Report. They read the local paper. They don't go on to World Net Daily. They read the local paper. They don't even know what's going on in their world. Here in San Francisco, we have a sad old newspaper that used to be a medium-grade, decent B paper. It's fallen completely into disrepute. No one takes it seriously. If people live upon the San Francisco Chronicle or their website, they don't even know what just happened to Michael Savage, even though they espouse liberalism and walk around with their heads held high thinking that they are the tip of the spear of liberation and freedom. They have no idea what's going on outside their little bubble of San Francisco. And I feel not pity for them. I actually feel contempt for them, to be honest with you, because of their pomposity and their absurdity. But I don't live in that bubble. I don't live in that bubble. I live in the world of what's really going on in the world. How do you explain that most politicians, most thinking people, read these websites I mention to you every day as a matter of habit? Now, let's talk about Michelle Obama, the paid apologists and sycophants of the Obama Politburo who work for AP and such. Tell us that Michelle Obama is the classiest first lady, even classier than Jackie Kennedy. And yet I don't know what this first lady has done to be called classy, but I do remember Jackie Kennedy quite well. She was quite something. And I'd like to play a piece from a blast from the past so you could hear what a real first lady sounds like. Listen.
These two were on loan from the Boston Museum of Fine Art. All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years. And then the most famous one of all is this one of Abraham Lincoln, which traditionally always hung in the state dining room. Healy was a contemporary of Lincoln, but he only saw him once, so he painted this picture from photographs.
Now, we don't know whose paintings have been taken down under Michelle's reign. We don't know whether H. Rapp Brown's picture has been put up, or Stokely Carmichael, or Malcolm X, maybe their portraits are hanging in the White House. We haven't any idea, but we do know that somebody has to say something at some point. You know, the Queen has no clothes. You know that one? Do you consider rap a form of poetry? I don't. Let me explain to you. I grew up reading real literature and listening to real poetry. Most of what you hear as poetry today is filth and garbage, dressed up and gussied up. It's written by illiterate morons who are using this opportunity to debase not only the United States of America, but the language itself. Listen to what real poetry is as we play for you Dylan Thomas's great poem.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good
okay.
Men, the last
beautiful.
Wave.
No, keep playing it. I love it.
How bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave yeah. Men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Yeah, he wrote that at his father's funeral. In honor of his father. Now compare that to the filth and garbage which they have the nerve to call poetry. And you wonder why so many children in this country can't read or write. You wonder why so many of them come out hating this society and hating America. You don't have to look any further than who's in the White House. Again, I say to you, that at a certain point, you have to stand up to the tyranny of the big lie.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I want to have some fun, so we're going to do a little nostalgia. I was talking about my young manhood when I worked my way through college as a primarily as a busboy. I don't even think I worked my way up to being a waiter. That was so, like, beyond me. I was a busboy in the Catskill Mountains, worked 16, 18-hour days. You made $100, $110 a week. Over 10 weeks, you made $1,000, $1,200, $1,300. In those days, that paid your tuition for the whole year if you went to a city or a state college. And that's what we did. That's all. We didn't ask for a government handout. We didn't go crying about racism. We didn't go beg anybody to go shake anyone down for a buck. You did what you had to do, and you went to college. That's if you had the brains and the drive. If you didn't, you didn't have to go to college. What'd you have to go for? Go take a job. I knew a guy who didn't go to college. He was actually considered stupid, and he didn't go to college. But listen to how it wound up. He was he was like a shame in the neighborhood. I forget his name. Marty, I think. I hope you're not listening, Marty. I'll get a lawsuit yet. He worked at a gas station. Everybody else, doctor, dentist, lawyer, this, that, accountant, if you couldn't do those things, if not a comedian, anything lower. So he couldn't go to college. He was like dumb. He worked as a gas, pumping gas in a local gas station. I liked the kid. We got along great. He was a nice guy. He always had greasy fingers and, you know, get under the car with the jack and the lift. We got along. I leave town after college. I go away. I work for my degrees. Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures. I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority. About 5-8 years after I leave New York, and I think I'm in this. I'm saving the world with my research, and isn't that? I inquire about Marty. Marty went to Florida before the real estate boom, started investing in property, became like a zillionaire, and had like 8 Rolls Royces. So, I mean, if you how do you add these things up? I mean, that's what you want. He did it. So who was smart? Well, Marty was smart. He knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to make money. That's all. So that brings us back to the Catskill Mountains and death plots. When I say death plots, I did that specifically to get the government agents listening more carefully. I realize that they're listening to me on a regular basis while watching pornography on their computers at government expense. So when I say death plots, I figure now they'll start to listen to me. I don't mean what you're thinking. I'm talking about Europeans who came over here in my father's generation had burial plots when they got here. The day they got here, they knew they were going to be buried. And most people that I know, and we're talking about people already who are mature already. Let's put it to you this way. If you were to put a dividing line through your life, most of them are way past the midline. Okay, let's put it to you that way. They don't know whether it's months, weeks, years. And let's say it's not minutes. But it's already way past the midline, and they still don't know whether they're going to be buried or cremated, above ground, below ground. They have no idea what to do with the remains. They don't know who should come into the house and go through the belongings. Nobody in my generation wants to make that decision. In many ways, my father's generation was far more, they were far more courageous. They knew already. They accepted their mortality, maybe because they were Europeans. You just say burial, people turn the show right off. They wanted to live Justin Bieber, Cyrus Miley, Myra Siley, Bel Air, houses, cars, skirts, drugs, alcohol, anything but facing the fact that they're mortal. Because they all think that most Americans today are living such a dreamland with everything handed to them. Irrespective of whether they were wealthy, they were spoiled, they were put on drugs very young in life, and then they took recreational drugs, and they're terrified of reality. Most people in America today who are born here believe that they are in some way separate from the zoological order. They think they broke free of the zoological order, and they're not made of the same stuff as a chicken. Okay? I mean, I say chicken because it could have been any animal. I didn't want to say pig because I didn't want to offend people of a certain religious orientation, so I said chicken. A chicken is not banned by any country on earth. It's a strange thing. Look how the pig is banned by Orthodox Jews. Then the Muslims copied that. They don't eat it either. But look how the Chinese love it. Go figure that one out. Which brings us back to the Catskill Mountains. because there was a place in the Catskill Mountains that was famous for serving roast pork on garlic bread, which we, the busboys and waiters, would eat around midnight. Because the people who went to the hotels ate the worst food on earth. We figured we had to better them. So instead of eating the food that they served in the hotel, after we got off duty at midnight, I think we go to the town. I don't remember the town, but there was one guy made a fortune. Because it was this is a very funny thing. He served roast pork on garlic bread. It became such a hit, such a gigantic hit. And most of the people who liked it the most are dead today as a result of heart attacks. Little did they know that they were clogging their arteries. But that's a separate story because many of them became cardiologists. They thought they were immune. It's like guys who specialize in a certain disease often die of it. That's something I discovered in graduate school. The first time I saw that people who are obsessed with certain diseases actually, I think on a higher level, die of them. They have an intuitive knowledge that that's what they're going to die from. They go in the field. So it's an interesting phenomenon. I remember when I was first in graduate school in pharmacology, I had an SOB for a department chairman. I'm glad he died young. I'll be honest with you. He got what he deserved, and he died a horrible death. I'm not saying I'm glad that happened, but on the other hand, when it happened, I was not unhappy. Let's put it to you that he was such a miserable, evil man. Did I tell you that story? I had no money. I had a very, very tiny $300 a month. I forget what fellowship it was to go to, like, for a year to study for a master's degree. So I'm working in this guy's laboratory, and he says to me, all right, your job is going to be to kill mice that we're experimenting on. You're going to take a thing, and you're going to put it in the back of their head, and you're going to pith them and kill them for the science. I said, I'm not doing it. He said, no, you're going to kill the mice, and that's what you got to do. That's your job. I said, I'm not going to do it. So he said to me, I'm going to tell you something, Michael. Either you're going to kill the mice or I'm throwing you out of the course and out of the laboratory and you're going to lose your fellowship. He knew we didn't have a dime other than the $300 a month fellowship. And he knew that if I lost it, I was broke. I had nothing. I said, well, you could throw me out if you want. I said, but I'm not going to kill the mice. I said, I may eat animals. I'm not going to torture an animal for your pleasure here in a laboratory. So he threw me out of the laboratory because I wouldn't kill the mice. I had nothing. That was the beginning of one of the luckiest breaks in my life because I wandered the halls of Leahy Hospital where this was going on in Honolulu, and I went down in the basement. I didn't get depressed. I said, this is horrible. I have no money. What am I going to do? And I noticed there were jars of herbs all over the wall in the showcases and said Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, herbs and leaves and roots. And I went, knocked on a professor's door, and I asked him, what are those things? Because I came from New York where, to me, a plant was a lettuce or a tomato. I didn't even know that there were more species than a lettuce or a tomato. I had never encountered anything more than a lettuce, a tomato, and a rose. I had no idea there were more than three species of plant at the time, having grown up in the asphalt jungle. So I knock on his door. I said, what are all these roots and herbs? He said, well, those are plants, and we study them for potential drugs, medicines. I said, that's amazing. Where does that stuff come from? Oh, he said, it comes from way down in the South Pacific in Samoa. I said, well, who sends him to you? So he names the a young professor, and I said, well, what is his field that he gets to get a government grant to go sit in a village? And he said, well, the field is called ethnobotany. Guess what? I became an ethnobotanist and one of the most famous of my generation. In fact, my master's thesis, which is better than most PhDs today, was published in the Harvard in a Harvard journal. It was published in the Journal of Economic Botany in its entirety, which are considered, if for those of you in the scholarly field, to get a master's degree published in a journal is the sine qua non of scholarship. I never talk about these aspects of my life because I know it's popular radio and you want to hear about Giuliani and this and that. So that, I mean, things happen. In other words, if you follow your belief system and your heart, things will often never work out. In my case, I was lucky.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Now listen up. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Oh, what did I want to ask you? Here, I left some lines open for this. I was trying to get to this all day, but my mind skips a beat every once in a while. People said, oh, Savage, you're prophetic in some ways, okay? I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to call this show right now, and I want you to ask me to give you a prophecy on a specific topic. Let's try that for 1 minute. Then you can nail me to a cross if it doesn't come out to be so. I'll put myself out on a line. I'll do what others don't dare to do. I'll make a prediction, which you'll call a prophecy. Ask me what's going to happen about X, Y, or Z, and I'll, if I can. I mean, it may be that I can't. But if I can compute something for you from the, you know, I will do so, okay? 1-800-449-8255. This is Michael Savage. Kyle in Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Hey, doctor. I wanted to say that if you did the Church of All Faiths idea, I think that would be a great deal. And I would come from the Napa Valley to see you live, absolutely, any day of the week.
I think a lot of people need this right now. They don't go to synagogue. They don't go to church. The flocks have disappeared. You know, you go by churches here in the Bay Area, and you know what you see? They're full on Tuesday nights with sex maniacs going to Sex Anonymous. They're full on Wednesday nights with Alcoholics Anonymous, with people who are trying to get off the juice. And on Thursday nights, they're filled with junkies who are trying to get off junk. So in that sense, churches are doing a wonderful job for society right now, but no one's going there to pray, by and large, not in this area.
And I was raised Catholic, you know, and I've stopped going to church, and I mean, I think it would bring a lot of people back to it. And,
well, what would you, as a lapsed Catholic, hope to hear from a church, a universal, let's say, service that I did on a Saturday or a Sunday, a Church of All Faiths?
I just want to hear an unbiased, you know, Bible readings and interpretations, like you were saying. I think that would be great. And, you know,
in plain English, in other words, I pick up the Bible and I read the portion of the Bible for that week. And then I interpret it from the point of view of the politics or the events that are happening in the world. As simple as that.
Right. As simple as that. I think that would be great because no one does that. And I think you could do an epic job of doing
that. Well, the reason they don't do it is because they say they try to keep politics out of the churches for the nonprofit reasons. But you know and I know most churches are liberal. You know and I know that 99 of 100% of liberal synagogues are 1,000% liberal politically. And they don't keep politics out of these places at all. Their bias is in almost everything that they do.
Right. They keep us out of us out of their politics, but they don't definitely not keep politics out of the church.
Incidentally, there's a very good note that I'm so happy to report. The ACLU, together with that psychopathic, pimple-faced moron, Barry Lynn of the atheists, whatever he is, sued a high school or a college in Texas and said you cannot say God, you cannot pray, you can't make any reference to the Bible in an invocation. And they won. They got some psycho judge who said that if anyone makes reference to God in the graduation ceremony saying, thank God, they will go to jail. That's what the judge said. Guess what? Overruled by the Fifth Circuit. The judge should be defrocked and derobed. He should be derobed, stripped of his robe. I don't really want to live in a country where psychopathic judges can do this to us. I am so tired of two discontented fools who get up and say, I don't want to hear anything about God, therefore no one can say anything about God in this church, in this ceremony. I'm sick of it. I am sick of living like this under the activism of these liberal judges. I'm sick of it.
Savage.
Okay, New York, Walter, go ahead, please.
You know, Mike, I was watching a show last night, and they were discussing kind of this whole thing, and they pointed out there's like... There's only like 7 million Mormons in the entire country, and we got almost 8 or 9 in the Senate and 8 or 9 in the House. I don't know. These Mormons, I think they're trying to literally take over the government and impose their little religion on everybody.
What, you believe that, or that's what they said?
I believe that.
But wait a minute. But you want me to put it another way? There's only a few million Jews, and there's an awful lot of Jewish people in Congress. Jews aren't taking over the country, are they?
Who knows? I've seen a lot of things where it seems like they're trying to, you know, especially with this thing with Israel. Right now, I don't particularly think we should be supporting Israel and a lot of these.
Well, let me ask you, are you a fundamentalist Christian yourself, Walter?
No, I'm an atheist.
You're an atheist. So you'd like to see more atheists in Congress?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Now that answer I could live with. It doesn't matter. Why should Mormonism matter to you, or Jewish Judaism or Islam? Why do they matter to you?
I think it's a hoax religion. I don't give it. Put it this way,
Hold it. Harry Reid is a Mormon. You know that, right? Do you approve of Harry Reid?
I don't disapprove or approve. He's a human being, Michael. His religion really doesn't mean much to me.
Wait a minute. But Mitt Romney's not a human being?
No, Mitt Romney is a human being. But when I see a disproportionate number of Mormons in the Congress and the Senate, I get curious.
But what do you mean by disproportionate? They weren't put there by God. They ran for office and won.
I bet you.
Let me give you another example. Let's say you look at Harvard University and there's a certain number of black students, white students, Asian students, or go to University of California at Berkeley, where the predominant number of students are of Asian descent. Do you say that that's disproportionate, or they earn their place there?
I would say no. Just that looking at it's disproportionate, but yes, in fact, they have earned their place there.
All right, but wait a minute. So it's disproportionate, but it doesn't mean they don't belong there.
Right, but
same in Congress. It may be disproportionate relative to the population of Mormons. Doesn't mean that they didn't earn their place in Congress.
But all I'm saying is I'm suspicious of their motives.
You think that there's sort of a secret handshake that the Mormons go through in the Hall of Congress?
I definitely believe that, Michael.
But only the Mormons, no other group?
Mormons more than any other group.
But wait, you're an atheist and yet you distrust Mormons more than any other religion? I want to see where your psychosis emanates from. In an age of terror where almost every bomb set off on the earth, in a shopping mall or amongst innocent people is set off by a radical Muslim, you fear Mormons more than radical Muslims?
No, I didn't say that at all. No, not at all.
Well, what did you say?
I say I don't trust Mormons. That's all I'm saying. If you ask me if I trusted Muslims, I would say no. I probably don't trust Muslims either.
All right. So you're generally you have an antipathy towards people of religion, basically.
No, I wouldn't say that either. I just don't particularly like Mormons.
Okay, you don't like Mormons. Why?
Well, I've known a few Mormons, and as far as I'm concerned, when I speak to a Mormon and he starts telling me about his Mormon beliefs, I think he's out of his mind.
Any different than Muslim beliefs?
I think they're out of their minds.
Any different than Catholic beliefs?
I think they're out of their minds.
Any different than Protestant beliefs?
Protestant, Jew, you pick it, Mike, they're all out of their minds.
God. Well, okay, so you're an atheist, and we got that back to where you started. Okay. So you believe in nothing?
No, I believe in the universe. I just don't believe. I don't believe that there's an all-seeing, all-knowing God out there that lives.
No, I'm very interested in what an atheist sees the world as. You say there is no God, there's no hereafter, there's no... We came from just, what, a drop of sperm that became through evolution? Otherwise, there's no soul then? There's no human soul?
The universe and all the things in it are built out of matter and energy, and when you die, that's where you go back to. You go back...
All right. Well, no, that's a very common belief system in an age of materialism where the churches have been hollowed out and the... temples are basically also of no great appeal to most people. People are now falling back upon strict materialism, which indicates that we're all a mechanistic being, period. That's what you believe. You don't have any bad moments in life where you say, what is it all about?
Well, everyone has bad moments in life, Michael.
So when you have really bad moments... Who do you go to in your prayers or your... What do? You say, oh, great matter in the sky, come and give me your energy?
No, I turn to myself. What have I... Put it this way, if it's a bad moment in my life, it's probably at my own hands.
So you're a strict... you generate it all. You are the center of your own universe. You're your own God, in essence.
Effectively, yes. I live by the golden rule. That's what I live by.
And the golden rule would be, do unto others as you would have them do unto you?
Exactly.
Well, to me, that's a religion then. That's a religious belief in a way.
No, it isn't.
Where did that golden rule come from? It didn't come from atheists, did it?
No, and it didn't come from the Bible either.
Where did it come from?
I don't know. You tell me.
It came from religious beliefs. That belief that you use as a founding basis of your operational behavior is a derivation of all of religion, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Otherwise, man would have no morality whatsoever. Man would be worse than most animals, which he is in most of the world. In other words, if there was no moral underpinning, what's to control your behavior? What prevents you from grabbing a small child off the street and hurting her? Why don't you do that, since you don't believe in any punishment other than in police? What prevents you from doing that?
Because I live by the golden rule, and I wouldn't want anybody to do that to me as a child or to a child that I know. So it's simple.
So you have a sense of morality, but where do you suppose the sense of morality derives from?
It derives from society.
All right, and okay, from civilized society, and civilized society has learned most of its morality and ethical behavior from religions. Otherwise, we'd have no morals and no ethics whatsoever. So when you analyze it, even though you don't believe in a hereafter or in God, you're actually living as though you do.
You know, Michael, that argument there, it's completely specious. Why? Because...
Well, I know it's a big word. I heard it in the 12th grade, but okay, so hold on a minute. We'll go on with my specious argument and yours in a minute.
Savage.
Sacramento, Petri, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michaels, you were talking about what would be your future job, your next job, and I was thinking that you can open up a jazz club in the North Beach. I mean, wouldn't that be great? Open up a jazz club. You could host the band. You can have a little sidekick talk and kind of...
It actually would be a lot of fun. It's something to think about. Are there any good jazz musicians left in America?
Well, good point. But do we have to limit it to jazz? You know,
I don't know. We could have disco, just play music from the great era of jazz. You know, that would be fun. And great era of rock and roll. I don't know. So a lot of things could be done, but I don't want a restaurant. The people I know in the business tell me it's a very, very difficult business, truthfully. And I really am not the kind of guy to sit and watch a cash register and worry about serving people. It's a very any cash business is a murderous business to run. Secondly, my books are global. My books before I was in radio were in 16 languages, my health books. You got to understand something. I wrote a book in 1982 called Maximum Immunity, published by Houghton Mifflin in Boston, that was in 6 languages. My books are translated in many languages. And so to go from that to running a nightclub, I don't know. You know, wouldn't you say that that's kind of a step down? But okay, but on the other hand, it's a step up in terms of humanity and dealing with people. That's what we're talking about. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that. That would have been the end of it for me. Okay? All right. Picasso, we're going to talk about for a minute. Florida, Paul, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
And, Dr. Savage, I was just calling. I had heard the earlier caller talking about Picasso, and I want
right.
to explain, I've got an art history background, and
yes.
you see these pictures of him where he's got like two noses on a woman. That's because he was experimenting with perspective, and so he might have two different perspectives, like a profile and a frontal view of the same model.
Okay, but stop right there. Then why didn't he pick one and then run with that one? Why did he leave two on the same painting?
Because he was experimenting in a time when the question was, what is art? Because you had Cubism, Surrealism, Dada, all of that, and the artists in that post-Impressionist era were questioning, what is art? So, you know, in that context, he didn't need to choose a profile or a frontal view of a model. He could combine them.
And also, you could follow that up by saying most of us see things in multiple perspectives at the same time anyway. In other words, if we're looking at a person, we don't see a single image of that person. We see a multi-layered personality in front of us, don't we? In other words, especially if we know the person, we're analyzing them, that individual is saying, well, that's interesting. You know, she's got a nice face, but I remember when, or I wonder if, correct? We're seeing multiple aspects of that human being in front of us. I would say that that's a reasonable analysis of Picasso's projections as well.
Exactly, and most of his models were girlfriends and mistresses and things like that, so he did know them. He had the, you know, the multiple...
Oh, today he'd be arrested as a perv for what he did. The country has become so crazy that an artist that we know, Picasso, a great artist, would be shackled and done the perv walk in the Pierre Hotel.
Oh, in a minute,
simply for using a model. They'd say, oh, you abused her, you exploited her. And he would say, but wait a minute, I paid her, and she was happy to live with me and have relations with me. No, you exploited her. She's going to get half of your estate. That's what happened today, the crazy world that we've devolved into because of the puritanism that's raging in this society. It's a, you talk about multiple perspectives. Right now, America is running on several different tracks at once, but on a moral level, we're running on two distinct tracks. One is the most prurient insanity I've ever seen, where these children go to raves with 5,000 people in a nightclub. They're all stoned on a drug. They lift their top up at a moment's notice. They have sex with anybody. Yep, crazed society. Insanity.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.
I'm going to take a caller right now from Kansas. Mark, you're on the one and only Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it is a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've been listening for a long time. I wanted to say I'm just amazed in this day and age, in 2011, with someone as learned as yourself, who just is one of the smartest people I listen to, can even believe in a God today. I mean, it shocks me, actually. That
I like that. I like shocking you. Do you find it offensive that a man of intelligence would believe in God?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's absolutely never been any proof of it. And in fact, if you're, you know, Catholic or someone who believes in the Bible, it was admittedly written by man. I mean, at least Muslims and other religions, you know, try to act like it was, you know, that their word was written by God. But I mean, even if you're, I was raised.
Okay, I've heard your discuss. I don't reject what you have to say, nor am I going to here to try to turn you into a religious person. But let me ask you something: do you believe Albert Einstein was super intelligent?
Of course.
Okay. Are you aware that Albert Einstein was a great believer in God?
Yes, I am.
Okay, no, I don't know, because a lot of atheists are confused because of the college posters of Einstein with the hair and with the tongue out that they put on campuses in order to debase his image. He said the more he studied the perimeters of the universe, the more he came to believe there had to be a God.
Right, but I also believe that religion is something that can shape you throughout your entire life. Things that he had gone through had, for some reason, you know, he had questions that could not be answered, and so he turned to religion, much like yourself. You had said that, you know, you had discovered him when you had hit the bottom. I think that, you know, like some people out there, like, you know, I hate to bring up his name, but like Jesse Ventura, or even like George Carlin used to say about God, that really it's something that if you have this hole in what you, you know, think is life, and you have no answers for that, you have to go to this, you know, invisible man that is supposedly up there watching everything we do and all the evil that...
No, I've heard the atheistic arguments, and it's all, you know, it's sort of hollow, the whole thing, because have you not had black moments in your life where there was nowhere to go? Who do you turn to? What do you turn to?
With religion, you're told that God only helps...
No, but I'm asking you, as a believing atheist, you believe in the religion of atheism, which is believing in nothing and nothingness, but you actually believe in something, which is nothingness, when you think about it.
I more believe in people or something physical than something that...
But have you ever fallen down a ravine and broken your leg and laying there with no one to rescue you? Who would you call?
There's no one to call. I mean, what good would calling God do? I mean, someone hears you.
So you'd pick up your cell phone and you wouldn't dial G-O-D, you dial 911. I get it.
Right. I mean, I don't think it's an argument. You know, I don't even want to say it's an argument. It's really just your belief system. You know,
that's right. You look, you're not going to convince me not to believe in a supernatural being that controls the universe. But you got to understand this about me. I do not believe God is omnipotent. I believe God is omnipresent. You know, there's a big difference.
That he's everywhere at all times, but he doesn't know everything.
See, many years ago, I went through a whole soul searching where I was about to become a total atheist. And I'd ask myself, how could a little child suffer from leukemia like this? How could a little child have cancer and suffer so violently? Why is it that evil men seem to thrive and get away with murder and rape and killing hundreds of thousands of people, while the innocent children, sometimes you go to a back ward of cancer and you see suffering amongst children? I said, what kind of God is there in heaven with a thing like this? And I found a book on this. It was written by I believe it was a Reform rabbi, and he was more a philosopher, and he said that if he believed God was omnipotent but not omnipresent, he would cease believing because he would not accept the God that was so cruel.
I guess I got to apologize. And when you say omnipresent, you mean that he's everywhere at all times, or what? I mean, what's the difference between?
I believe that God's work is apparent everywhere. If I'm sitting in my radio studio looking out of the window and I see a bush, and I see an airplane, and I see the breeze, and I see a bird, okay? These are all manifestations of God to me.
Okay.
To me. It doesn't mean I see a spiritual being walking around who's going to wind up in my living room. I'm not Jimmy Carter. I don't believe he's going to show up in a white robe in my living room and I have to drink strychnine in order to prove it.
That's all the proof you need that there is a God, is because there are these things that are present that you see every day.
Yes. In other words, how could this ever happen by accident?
I think that there's many, many things, and I think you'd agree with this, there's many, many things in the world that cannot be explained by us. I think that man is, you know, pretty low on the...
Wait, but you just touched again on something you've struggled with all your life, and I agree with you. There are many things we can't understand. So what do you do at that moment when you reach a point you can't understand? What do you turn to? I don't understand it, and that's enough for you?
Well, no, I try to study as much as I can of things that have actually happened and people that have lived in the world and experienced what is to experience in the world and maybe what they're... I kind of see it as a study that you spend your whole life trying to...
Look, we're not going to change each other's mind. A belief is a faith. That's all there is. It's a faith and period. You can't prove it. It's a faith. That's why it's called faith-based.
In this horrible, disgusting world with what goes on every day, how can you have faith in this being? Even if there is a God, say that there is a God. If there is a God, how could he be such an incredibly cruel being to allow what happen in the world? You know how there was...
I have asked the same question. I've gone right there. I'm not different than Mother Teresa, who doubted God's existence at times in her life, but still trekked along on the path of God. Because there's no alternative. I cannot take myself off this path at this point in my life. It's impossible.
You know the story of Noah's Ark, obviously. Flood, you know, because everything was so evil in the world that he needed to wash it clean, basically, and start over. You can't tell me that after all these thousands of years after that things are not 10,000 times worse than they were back then. And
yeah, but who says there's not going to be another flood?
Right, there could be, but it's been so long. I mean, there's just no...
Yeah, it's been a long time. That's why I have survival food on a hillside house somewhere.
I'm with you. I mean, I do think it's probably coming, but I think we're more likely to destroy ourselves before that actually happens. But I just...
Yeah, that's a whole separate discussion. I want to ask you something. You've got my curiosity. Were you raised in any religion?
I was raised as a Catholic. I went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. I was confirmed in the Catholic religion, although at confirmation I was right towards the time of not, you know, of really falling out of belief. But
what made you a lapsed Catholic? Something happened in your life? What happened?
You know, I was the weird kid that was like 9 or 10 years old in Catholic. You know, if you're in Catholic schooling, you go to church probably 2 or 3 times a week. And so I would sit in church and the priest would want us to be involved. So he would ask us questions and I would be the weird kid that stood up and said, okay, look, you know, if there is a God, then, you know, why does these bad things happen? Blah, blah, blah. And they never had
yes.
an answer for me. And
all right. No. Hey, that happens in every religion. Every religion has kids who ask these questions. You're not the weird one. You're the smart one. You're the one who challenges authority. I understand that, but I've been that way all my life.
Right. right. I felt weird because there was no other child, and in fact, I was laughed at for even.
Here's the thing about it. Do you do things in your life that you're ashamed of? Things that you really wish you didn't do?
Of course.
Okay. So who do you apologize to for that?
There is nobody to apologize to.
Don't you do any mea culpa saying, God, I'm sorry, I've sinned, I can't help myself?
No.
Well, what do you say to yourself? What do you say to yourself at that point?
You know what? I don't. I don't have those kind of internal monologues. I basically try to live my life. You know, I feel that the Ten Commandments are a great way to live. I think that, you know, all of the things that they list are things that you should probably try to do.
Did you say the Sixth Commandments? You're sounding like Anthony Weiner now.
No, I said the Ten Commandments.
I'm joking. Come on. Because most Democrats believe in four commandments.
If you listen to George Carlin, it should really be like two, because a lot of them are the
last. No, but most Democrats believe in four commandments. Well, it's an interesting conversation we've had so far, Mark. We haven't changed each other's position, and nor did we try to. We were like gentlemen having a discussion, which is the object of a discussion, which is not really to move the other guy, but just hear the other guy out. Would you agree with me on that?
Absolutely, yeah. I listen to you every day. I do love your show a lot, and I really do believe that you are just an incredibly intelligent person. I can't believe the radio is where you landed up, you know, from being a professor and being all these things that you could have been or have done in your life, that you didn't go into a different path, and you're basically...
Well, I know that it's very interesting, but I was blocked in my desires to make a life in academia because I was a white male, although my credentials were the best on earth. They were only choosing people who were of a certain, let's say, stripe. But that's a long time ago. I have a large classroom every day with 8 to 10 million listeners a week. You can do the math. I mean, the audience is bigger in one probably 10-minute period than I would have had in my entire life as a professor. So things worked out very well. Also, the sale of the books is great. I have no complaints on that level at all. I'm not sitting here grousing about what happened. It was all, and I'm going to say this something now you're not going to believe, it was all God's will. See, I actually believe that it was all God's will. God did not want me to be limited to be a professor. He wanted me to be the voice of reason on the air.
Savage.
It's funny, we got a lot of callers on the prophecy thing where I say, okay, ask me to prophesize on a specific topic. And I'm getting people calling with specific questions like predict the price of gold. That's a prediction. That's not I can't do prophecy on that. How do I know what the price of gold is going to be tomorrow? I assume it's going to go up and up and up based upon the fact that they're not even printing money anymore. You understand what Geithner's doing? They're not even running the presses. They're just saying that they digitally transferred funds to something else. There is no basis to the currency anymore. It's fantasy. How'd that paper currency idea work out, Richard Nixon? Ask Richard Nixon. I'll never forget, I was a young guy, I didn't really understand a lot when Nixon took us off the gold standard and he opened the doors to China with the Metternich of our time. You know who the Metternich of our time is, don't you? The most diabolical man of the century, Henry Kissinger. When he did that, I said, wait a minute, this is crazy what Nixon's doing. How do you call that republicanism? This doesn't make sense. It's just nuts. All right, let's go to the callers. Abe in New York, welcome to the Savage Nation from WOR. Go ahead, please.
Will Israel be in existence in 5 years from now? The state.
I'm sorry, you asked me if Israel will still exist 5 years from now.
The state of, yeah, not the people.
Not the people, but the state of Israel. That's a very intriguing differential. I think by your question, you're giving somewhat of an answer, aren't you?
I think so.
Instead of playing Talmudic riddle with you, you're suggesting that it will not be here as a nation. It will only be a land, another Mediterranean land, which has lost its homogeneity as a Jewish state. Correct?
Yeah, I think the it's connected. The United States with Israel. If not the United States, there would never be a state of Israel, and now both. The existence of the state of Israel as a Jewish state is a lot of depending on the existence of the U.S. So you can see both on very other.
So you see that as the U.S. weakens, so does Israel, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's two other kind of directions, but it's...
Well, I'm not so sure that that's 100% true. I believe that Israel, in making and forging new alliances with other emerging superpowers such as India, could actually survive, even if, God forbid, the U.S. were to slip into a state of being like a kind of a Spain or Portugal.
I think the state of Israel is something like Ellis Island, when the immigrants used to arrive over here, and they thought that Ellis Island, this is America. Then,
well, I don't know. I don't want to spend too much time on Israel. Truthfully, I'm more interested in what's going on in America. I think that if America goes, the world goes. And I believe that with Obama in the White House, we're going and going, but we're not gone yet. If China knows something that the liberals don't know, that's very, very telling. If his own party votes against him, which they did on Libya, and said, wait a minute, Jackson, you just violated the Constitution by dragging us into a war that you have no authority to do without our vote. How can there's been no discussion about Libya? We actually know more than the State Department does. You know, three women dragged us into the war with Libya. It was Hillary Clinton and two of the other women dragged us into a war against Gaddafi. No one is supporting Gaddafi and saying he's a great human being. But take a look at who's waiting in the wings. Throughout the entire arc where the so-called Arab Spring is occurring, there is the Muslim Brotherhood emerging. Let me say it again in case you missed that succinct statement. Throughout the entire arc where the Arab Spring is allegedly occurring, the Muslim Brotherhood is emerging. I told you this was happening when this started. And I told you the dirty money that was coming in and funding it. And I told you the stupid minds that were behind it. It was Brzezinski. It was the Carter School of Stupidity. The same SOBs who destroyed the Shah of Iran, thinking that they would usher in democracy if they got rid of the Shah of Iran. Guess what came to Iran? They made the country safe for the return of the worst scourge that the world has ever seen. Khomeini comes back from exile in Paris, and he brings the disease of radical Islam to Iran, and the people have been living in a state of terror ever since Carter did that to them. So these psychotics under Carter, Brzezinski et al., do the same thing now across the entire arc of North Africa into Egypt. And we see this. We see this. But what does Hillary Clinton do? What does Obama do? Obama forgave $1 billion in aid to Egypt. You hear a thing like this? Presto, with $1 billion, no congressional discussion, no debate which says, now, wait a minute, maybe it isn't a good idea because perhaps we're going to see something worse emerge than Mubarak. After all, Mubarak was our best friend. He kept these psychotics under control for 30 years. So now you see him gone, and who's emerging? The people he threw out of power, the people he kept out of power. That's your idea of what you want in Egypt, the most populous Muslim nation on earth? We the people see this, but there was no discussion in Congress. You open the Daily News and you hear what the headline is. Scarlett Johansson leaves Psycho. Scarlett Johansson leaves the psycho actor who can't write an entire paragraph because he's so stoned all of the time. A-Rod and Cameron Diaz call it Splitsville. That's the headline in the New York News. The moment that Isaiah Thomas came back, Donnie Walsh was doomed as a Nick. Now, how can a country survive when people are this stupid? Is the question, that they would read such trash as this, which poses as journalism, and liberal journalism, no less. Every day, if they can, they bash a conservative in the Daily News. How can a country survive with such pathetic stories as the lead? Did you see one story in the Daily News that says Congress, including Democrats, reject Obama on Libya? Would have been a screaming headline in my day. Prez overruled on Libya. Okay, that would have been the headline. Not anymore, because they're in his pocket. That's all. It's that simple. And is Shaq heading to ESPN? Who reads that newspaper? Pete in New York, welcome to the Savage Nation on WOR.
Dr. Savage, I have a direct quote from Federico Fellini that I know you'll love. He once said, in my dreams, I am free.
You know, it's true. It's where the dreams, the dream state approaches the life state is the perfect state.
Absolutely, and there's no place else in the world we can experience that but right here.
Absolutely, yeah. This earth, the only heaven. I agree with you.
We can turn off our leader's voice whenever we want to, and escape into the land you went to, and everything is bliss.
Do you mind that I talked about it? Did you find it kind of boring that I was just telling you about a wonderful night I had?
Not at all, and that's why I find it so wonderful listening to your show, because it's unpredictable. I could listen to the guy that sounds like Groucho Marx, but I choose to listen to you.
To each his own. Look, the fact of the matter is I have my own way of looking at the world, and I can only take so much of Obama and so much of politics, and then eventually I will revert to my poetic nature, and my poetic nature is meandering. It's a meandering soul that we all have anyway, and the soul is unpredictable. So it's when I let my soul roam freely, as I have most of my life, although I'm highly disciplined, I do have a soul that's quite restless. I've learned a lot along the way, and I've delved into an awful lot of things, and sometimes I have the ability to cook it up into a good verbal stew. Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures. I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority.
Well, it brings such flavor to your the broadcast. You're a man with a wealth of knowledge and experience, and I really appreciate the work you do.
Thank you. That's very nice. You see, an educated man knows. The others, they don't know what you're doing. You say educated, what, they have to have a higher degree? No. Just